Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm August Baker. We're talking today with Dr. Joel Whitebook about his book, Freud, An Intellectual Biography. Dr. Whitebook is a philosopher and psychoanalyst who maintained a private practice for 25 years and is on the faculty at Columbia University. Welcome, Dr. Whitebook.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I wanted to know to start, if there's some more you'd like to say to the listeners about your background, your intellectual orientation, your influences, mentors, things like that that might be helpful for people approaching the book.
Yes, I think that would be a good idea. My general background has been in critical theory in the tradition of the Frankfurt School. I started out as a philosopher, and then after completing a doctorate in philosophy, became a psychoanalyst. But the type of philosophy that I was oriented towards, or the school that I was trained in, which, as I mentioned, was a Frankfurt School, was one of the first, if not the first, group of philosophers and social scientists in Europe to take Freud seriously, to teach him in the university. And in fact, they even promoted his receiving the Goethe Prize in Frankfurt. And he was a pillar of their project, along with Marx and Hegel and Max Weber. They attempted to formulate a critical theory of modernity by integrating these four major figures. So a main element of their project was the integration of psychoanalysis into a critical theory of society, or you might say a critical theory of modernity. And that's the project which I have tried to pursue and continue to pursue. And you could describe my work in recent years is an attempt to update what earlier critical theorists in the Frankfurt School tradition have done in terms of psychoanalysis and critical theory by bringing more recent developments in psychoanalysis to bear on critical theory.
I see. Okay, that's very interesting. And what were the four figures you said, Freud, Marx, who were the other two?
I would say Marx, Hegel, Freud, and Max Weber.
Okay. And I wanted to note also that you say in the beginning of your book that your aim is not to here to provide a comprehensive biography. There are many of those. And you say you want to provide a narrative of the relation between Freud's life and his work, which is a very psychoanalytic thing to do, and you want to try to do it without being reductive. And you say you want to do it from the perspective of two particular themes. Could you tell the listeners about those two themes?
Yes. when I was asked to do the book by Cambridge University Press, it was specifically to be an intellectual biography, which meant that my task was to interpret the development of Freud's thinking against the backdrop of what was going on in his life and in the general culture. So when I say it's not a general biography, what I meant by that more specifically was that it was an intellectual biography. Excuse me. And the two themes which organize my narrative are what I've called the break with tradition, which tries to locate Freud in the historical developments of his day and in terms of the theorists who are trying to understand those developments. And then also the second theme was what I call the missing mother, which has to do with the fact that the theme of the mother is sorely underdeveloped in Freud's thinking.
Okay, that's very helpful. Would you, I mean, as I read the book, which I really enjoyed, I was thinking you're looking at his life and his work. But it's not just, you know, here's his early childhood and here's his theories. You're also looking at his, you know, his love life, you might say, his passions and his battle with illness. So you're kind of intertwining his theories and his logic, his theories and his life throughout his life. Is that accurate?
Yes, and I'd say that, but I'd specify it even more. There are sort of two schools of thought when it comes to relating a person's life to their work. One school of thought is what you might call the Kantian, for lack of a better word. And that says that a person's biography shouldn't be taken into consideration in appreciating their work or in evaluating or interpreting their work, but that the work should stand in its own right and be approached in its own terms. In other words, you shouldn't try and understand a Mozart symphony or opera in terms of what we know about Mozart's life. And that goes for any great thinker. And the worry there is reductionism. They want to guard against having a person's work reduced to its genesis and the person's life history. And you know, often turns into a sort of gossip where you try and uncover the dirty linen in a person's life as a way of reducing their work. Now, that's a valid concern, but they go too far in the other extreme and just want to consider the work in its own right without any consideration of its genesis and the development of a person's life.
That's a good point, because you are talking about new developments in psychoanalytic theory throughout the book.
Well, I'll come to that after I make one more point. Mm-hmm. The other pole, which, as I've already indicated, is reductionism. Which you found in earlier forms of either vulgar Marxism or vulgar Freudianism, or now you might even say in neuroscience, which tries to reduce a person's accomplishments, to debunk them in a way by reducing them to something, some lower level explanation. In vulgar Freudian terms, it would be in terms of their psychosexual life. In vulgar Marxist terms, it would be in terms of their economic situation. And today, you might say, in neuropsychological terms, it would be reducing them to their brain chemistry. So that's the other pull that has to, it's a cilia and a charybdis. And that's the charybdis, as opposed to the Kantian cilia, which has to be avoided. Now, the third position, which I would say is the truly psychoanalytic position, and one which Freud himself advocated, is trying to understand the relationship between what is called genesis and validity, how certain things, accomplishments arose out of the conditions of a person's biography, but somehow achieved an objective validity of their own, which, while being related to those circumstances, isn't reducible to them. Mm. And of course, he postulated the idea of sublimation as a marker to explain this process, whereby genetic material gets turned into valid cultural objects, you might say.
Right. I keep thinking about this quotation that you have here, and maybe this is related. You talk about Freud coming to understand the human mind as naturally oriented toward the external world and resisting an attempt to redirect its gaze inward. And you have a quote that he wrote to Albert Einstein: "All our attention is directed to the outside, whence dangers and satisfaction beckon. From the inside, we want only to be left in peace. So if someone tries to turn our awareness inward, then our whole organization resists. Just as, for example, the esophagus and the urethra resist any attempt to reverse their normal direction of passage." And you say this observation helps us understand the widespread hostility towards psychoanalysis.
You want me to comment on that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I make several points. First of all, one way I would say, a very interesting way, or actually the way that I would put it, and I take this largely from somebody who deeply influenced me and who I draw on and mention in the book, but who's not that well known in this country, namely a Greek philosopher and psychoanalyst who lived in Paris for many years named Cornelius Castoriadis. And Castoriadis argued that Freud's project, what we should take from Freud's project, is the attempt to understand the relationship between psychic reality and social reality, between the inner world and the social world. And of course, one could argue that Freud's great discovery in the interpretation of the dreams was psychic reality, that we are citizens of two worlds. We live in the world of psychic reality, and we live in the world of social reality. And that the real interesting question and the goal is to try and understand the relationship between the two. Now, the next point is, there are many reasons why there is many explanations for why there is such a resistance, indeed a hostility towards psychoanalysis, going back to the fact that Freud discovered, you might say, infantile sexuality, or that he said that we have innate aggressive drives, which seems to contradict the conventional picture of human beings as being essentially good and sociable, or even going further, that we have a death instinct. I mean, all these are help to explain or are good reasons for accounting for the hostility or resistance, as analysts say, to psychoanalysis. But in the quote that you read, that points to another resistance, which I think is equally powerful and which is only being appreciated more in recent years, which is people's resistance to psychic reality. Resistance to the fact that we are determined to a large extent by inner events which we don't have great control over. Or as Freud put it, the ego is not master in his own house. And one of the difficulties in clinical work and helping somebody to get involved in a psychoanalytic process is helping them to accept the fact that there is this powerful psychic reality, and that one is better off dealing with it than leaving it alone. I mean, all too often, patients, people in treatment, would much rather attribute their problems to the external world, to society, to their spouses, to their bosses, what have you. For some reason, it seems to be a fact that it's easier to attribute things to the external world than to look within. And one final point. I think today, when we live in a world where we are constantly distracted by screens, everywhere you go to your doctor's office, there's a television, you go to the train stations, there are television. Even now when you go to a gas station, they have these little screens while you're filling your tank. And, you know, all I have to do is walk down the street and everybody's got their nose buried in a phone. And today, we are bombarded by so much external stimuli that it makes the task of turning inward even that much more difficult. And, you know, there are innumerable reasons for the decline of psychoanalysis in today's culture. But I would say this is perhaps a more recent one, but one of the very powerful ones.
That's a very powerful point. Could you give a quick overview of the Frankfurt School? Because when I hear you saying that we're going to be combining Freud and Marx, I'm thinking of that as Freud being more the internal and Marx more the external.
Well, one way to understand that, I mean, they were a group of German Jewish philosophers and social scientists who started out in the 20s, but really consolidated in the 30s at the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt. Excuse me. And while they were generally Marxists in their orientation, they were never dogmatic and they were always anti-Stalinists. But when in the 30s, one had an economic crisis, the Great Depression, which according to Marxist predictions should have produced a socialist revolution, it in fact produced just the opposite, namely a large part of the European working class was turning to fascism. And this was an anomaly, to put it mildly, that any Marxist had to confront. And methodologically, the critical theorist in the Frankfurt School concluded that the problem was that Marxism didn't contain what's referred to as a subjective didn't study the subjective dimension. In other words, consciousness subjectivity was basically reduced to material conditions. So in order to explain the fact that the working class hadn't fulfilled its historical mission, but on the contrary, had done just the opposite, they concluded, A, that Marxian theory had to be augmented by psychology and that Freudian depth psychology was the best to do it, and that they could deploy Freudian categories to try and explain why this had occurred. And under the directorship of Max Horkheimer, they produced a series of volumes called Authority in the Family, which tried to explain the makeup of German working class in terms of its peculiar their peculiar family relations and how this gave rise to an authoritarian character or sensibility.
That's helpful. Thank you. And then, as I understand, your project would be to take some of the more recent developments in psychoanalysis and and build them in. And as I understand it, much of that is under the label of pre-Oedipal as opposed to Oedipal, or what you call the missing mother. Is that correct?
Yes. One could argue that the most significant development after Freud's death, which is to say in psychoanalysis since the Second World, is the so-called pre-Oedipal turn, which is the turn towards understanding the first 3 years of life and the relationship, the infant-child relationship. I mean, my thesis in the book is that Freud was basically a theorist of what he called the father complex. When you read his case studies one after another, it's always a polemic for the importance of the father complex, the Oedipus complex. He referred to the Oedipus complex as the nuclear complex of the neuroses. He, in his cultural writings, most notably in Totem and Taboo and Moses and Monotheism, he explained the origins of religion in terms of the Oedipus complex. So when the Frankfurt School, not only the Frankfurt School, but most psychoanalytically oriented social theorists prior to the 60s say, and there are a few exceptions, adopted Freudian theory to explain social phenomena, they basically employed his Oedipal theory, his theory of the father complex. So that after the Second World War, and we could discuss the reasons for this, there was an intense interest in the early mother-infant relationship developed. And a number of the most important psychoanalysts after the war, and I would say Donald Winnicott is the most important here, started exploring the first 3 years of life, the early separation individuation process. Then that was followed by infant research and attachment theory. So the great augmentation of psychoanalytic theory has been the addition of pre-Oedipal theory to Oedipal theory. So when I am trying to expand and continue the project of the Frankfurt School, which, as I said, is to try and integrate critical theory and psychoanalysis, what I've tried to do is to examine how we would rethink some of the central problems using pre-Oedipal rather than Oedipal theory.
Interesting. That makes it very clear. And I guess to help understand it, could you help explain in treatment what a classical, how treatment proceeds and psychoanalytic treatment proceeds for a classical patient, one with, you know, that is seen as an Oedipus complex versus a unclassical one with pre-Oedipal issues?
Yeah. Perhaps Winnicott put it best. He said Freud basically not ignored, but radically didn't pay sufficient attention to the first 3 years of life. That is the years of life when separation, individuation takes place until what's called a unit self is formed, the consolidation of self, which takes place in the third or fourth year. So Freud assumed the existence of a unit self, which had an interior structure, which he said was made up of the id, ego, and superego, and that this person interacted with other unit selves and suffered from what were called intrapsychic conflicts. That is, conflicts that occurred within a self that was already unified in form. And his approach to psychoanalysis, his clinical technique, his understanding of the psychoanalytic setting was all predicated on the idea that he was a unit self and he was dealing with other unit selves, and that the analysis involved the interaction between these unit selves. What this meant in practice was that, I mean, this is how he described what was referred to as the classical patient or the good neurotic. And in practice, what this meant was that these people were basically able to make use of the psychoanalytic setup, or what's called the psychoanalytic frame, and be able to abide by the structure of psychoanalysis and come so many times a week and free associate and accept interpretations and would be helped in terms of interpretation. Now, one of the things that, whether or not this classical patient ever existed is a disputed issue, but we won't get into that. One of the things that led to the pre-Oedipal turn after the war, and this was especially true in London, but also in the States, that analysts were seeing more and more patients who couldn't be reached with the classical method. Not only couldn't be helped by it, but often couldn't be reached by it. They sort of, you might say, couldn't accept the rules of the game that were necessary to involve oneself in psychoanalysis.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in order to understand this, the new patient, the post-classical patient, the non-neurotic patient, however you want to call it, analysts began examining pathology, which stems from the earlier phases of life, relationship to the early mother, the separation individuation process, as I said, the formation of a stable unit self, which meant that those issues themselves became the topic of psychoanalytic interventions, what are called pathologies of the self. And in addition to, or before, I mean, there's difference of opinions about this, and it varies from case to case, before dealing with Oedipal issues having to do with later stages of development, it's necessary to address issues with the patient that stem from these early forms of what's self-pathology, or what's sometimes referred to as narcissistic pathology.
I thought this probably relates. You say when these people, meaning unclassical patients, are able to articulate their experience, they provide us, and you're referring to Loewald. Loewald maintains, with insight into the psychotic core of the personality, which is rarely accessible in higher functioning individuals, though it is present in all of us. Maybe that's what you meant by whether there ever was a classical patient. Could you speak to this psychotic core?
Well, I mean, this is also somewhat a matter of contention. But if you assume, as I do, and as Lowell does. By the way, he's one of the, I would say, one of the most important theorists after Freud, and one who has influenced me enormously, that we begin life in some sort of undifferentiated or symbiotic stage, or a stage of merger with the mother, and that development consists in moving away from, differentiating oneself away from that originally undifferentiated stage. Then, well, if you take that line of analysis, and you also believe that earlier stages of development aren't just eradicated, but somehow stay active in the psyche, or somehow sedimented in psychic life, then you can assume that residues of that undifferentiated stage, what he calls a psychotic core, psychotic meaning because it's a merged state. Okay. Psychotic core exists in all of us. It just in patients who are able to, or for whatever developmental reasons, achieve a higher degree of individuation and a more firmly structured and stable self, that core is further buried. But in patients, the post-classical patients I've been mentioning, that stage remains less well buried and is more accessible and is encountered more easily than it is. You know, the neurotic patient, the so-called high-functioning patient, in some way doesn't have access to the more archaic, or it's more difficult for them to gain access to the more archaic parts of the personality having to do with this psychotic core. So that when we deal with the less high-functioning patients, I want to use terms that are non-judgmental here,
right?
Non-stigmatizing. So that when we deal with the less high-functioning patients, we often gain insight into deeper levels of the psyche that aren't accessible with the higher-functioning patients. And as Gowald says, they can teach us, and Winnicott, he took this from Winnicott, believe they have a lot to teach us about what Winnicott said, what life is all about.
And Freud, of course, would be a very, very high-functioning patient who may not have had so much access. Well, he didn't go through an analysis either.
I want to say something.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, the received interpretation of Freud, which he himself promulgated and which analysts believed for many years, was that he was a high-functioning neurotic patient who hadn't suffered any early traumas and that he was very well put together. But what research into his early life in Freiburg by historians and by academics and Freud studies has revealed in recent years, and this is one of the points of departure of my narrative, is that in fact his first 3 years in Freiburg and his relation to his mother was really quite traumatic.
Right.
And that this presentation of himself as this high-functioning, rational, well-integrated, quotes, normal, masculine person was in many ways defensive. Mm-hmm. And what he had done was actually split off and repress the earlier stages in his own life and the psychic phenomena that are attached to them.
Right.
And that, because he had denied this part of himself, because he had dissociated himself from his earlier years and his more primitive experience, he wasn't able to see it in his patients and incorporate it in his theory. And that's why I have the thesis of the missing mother. And part of my, what I attempted to do was to trace the ramifications of this throughout the history of his theory.
That's very helpful. Yes, and I think another bit of new research is the letters to or the letters from Wilhelm. The letters that Freud wrote to Wilhelm Fleisch,
letters
right?
Between both of them.
They were only available in 2011, yeah. So that's another piece of something that was hid that also you make a great use of here. You know, we don't have a lot of time, but do you want to talk about some of the early, I mean, there's just so much to talk about, some of the early trauma that has been revealed?
Well, before doing that, if we can do both, I'll try and be quick. I mean, I'd like to say something about the Fleisch letters.
Yes.
The Freud establishment, which was made up of Heinz Hartmann and Ernst Kruss and Anna Freud, believed that in order to protect Freud's reputation and the fragile reputation of psychoanalysis, they had to suppress some of the more controversial material in his life. So when the Fleisch letters were first discovered in the 50s, a very censored, expurgated edition of them was brought out by Anna Freud and Ernst Kruss. And that was sort of the official view that was followed until Anna Freud died in the 80s and Jeffrey Mason brought out a complete unexpurgated version. And what this, what the complete letter, and by the way, the letters are fantastic. They are almost, I would say, a piece of literature. And it's like an unprecedented, they offer you an unprecedented view into the inner workings of a man's mind and a struggle to, and his struggle to understand himself. And also you see what a compassionate and thoroughly human person he was. Mm-hmm. It's not just Freud, warts and all. It's Freud and all his humanity. And
right.
The Freud establishment in some way, one thought they had to deny his humanity. And my experience was in reading them and seeing him in all his vulnerability, rather than turning me off to him, it made me appreciate him much more. But once you had the Fleisch letters where he gave some hints about what had actually gone on in his first 3 years in Freiburg, this led to research into those years, which uncovered how problematic and traumatic his relationship to his mother had been.
Right. And of course, the Fleisch letters also refer to, and there's some, you know, homosexual or homoerotic excitement there. You have this quote where Freud is anticipating an upcoming Congress, and he wrote to Fleisch, "I bring nothing but two open ears and one temporal lobe lubricated for reception." Obviously, this is a long, I don't know if you've read the biography of Kohut by Strozier, but the way the psychoanalytic establishment, you know, frowned on homosexuality or needed to distance itself from homosexuality is a big part of the story, at least in the U.S.
Well, I think it's a big part of the story of the way the Freud establishment tried to control the publication of these things. I mean, I quote a feminist theorist, I think her name was Garner, I don't remember, who said when she first read the Fleisch letters, she said it occurred to her that these were love letters. And
right.
Although we have no evidence that they was ever enacted, completed sexually, he was passionately in love with this man. And the homosexual love is, you know, is not just can't be denied, and like the passage you just quoted, I mean, it's there to be observed, as is the extent of his cocaine usage, which Jones said ended, before, I think in the late 1880s, but in fact, it went on to 1896. So they felt like they had to bury these facts in order to preserve his reputation. And in addition to the pre-Oedipal turn in psychoanalysis, I think the fact that the culture has become much more tolerant towards homosexuality and the analytic world has made a valiant attempt to make amends for the past and revise its views on homosexuality, it makes it much more possible for us to view his the homosexual dimension of his relationship to Fleece as well as to Jung, to view it in a much more neutral way.
Right. I thought it was really convincing to me as an outline of him, Freud first falling in love at 16 and then kind of being, correct me if I'm wrong, being kind of overwhelmed by that, turning to work, then falling in love with Martha, and then having the passion of a love affair, which is separated by distance and put into writing. And then once he gets married and Martha becomes the mother at home, there's kind of like, well, where does all of this energy go? And then Wilhelm Fleiss was there and it went right there. That's, correct me if I'm wrong, that's the overview I got from your book.
Yes, and there's one more point to it. That, you know, it's often been said that Freud was an epistolary lover.
Yeah.
He was separated from Martha for 6 or 7 years during their so-called betrothal, their engagement. Martha's mother didn't particularly like Zygmunt, and she grabbed her daughter out of Vienna and dragged her to Hamburg so she'd be away from him. So for the greater part of their engagement, he didn't see her that much. And this love affair took place to a large degree in his fantasy life, which was recorded in these wonderful letters, all of which have been recently published. So he was able to maintain this passionate and idealized love as long as the real object wasn't there. And then when he finally had to move in with her and, you know, see her doing the dishes, or I guess they didn't do dishes or whatever, it sort of collapsed. And then all of that passion was redirected towards Fleece. But again, Fleece lived in Berlin, and he didn't see him that often. And he carried on an epistolary, largely an epistolary love affair with Fleece.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, one of the hardest tasks for all of us, and one of the tasks in most therapies and analyses, is learning to give up our idealized fantasies and our narcissistic self-protection and love a real human being with all their flaws and who won't conform to our wishes.
And another, I guess, at one point you talk about transference and, you know, you say that it's often questioned what Freud's fundamental discovery was, and is it the meaning of dreams, the existence of psychic reality, free association, or even the psychoanalytic setup itself? You note that the question is impossible to answer. But you also talk about transference and the way it's enacted both inside and outside of the psychoanalytic setting, and that is a prime candidate for his fundamental discovery. And then you talk about, I wondered if you could talk about his relationship with Wilhelm Fleiss as a transference drama and as having, you know, both an Oedipal and a pre-Oedipal level. I think you said in the pre-Oedipal stratum, Fleiss was in the role of a breast mother that you wanted to surrender to. And on the Oedipal level, Freud was in what he considered a passive homosexual attitude.
Yeah. First of all, people tend to think of transference as just one thing, but transferences assume many forms deriving from all layers of psychic life and stages of development. And with Fleece, I mean, I don't remember who it was. Somebody observed, you know, Fleece actually became his doctor and started intervening on him, operating on his nose and cauterizing it. We're not exactly sure what he did, but he did operate on him. So I think we all know from our experience as little children that one develops these powerful transferences to their doctors. I mean, they're seen as these very powerful figures, these authority figures, these magicians who carry the magic of curing you.
So sure, surgeons.
Especially surgeons, yeah. So the fact that Fleece became his doctor meant that Fleece was open to all the transferences that are associated with the figure of the father doctor, and which meant he was an authority figure. He had all the scientific knowledge, not just magical knowledge. You know, he addresses one letter to him, "Dear magician," excuse me. And, you know, and the sort of passive homosexual mode, I mean, that's Freud's term for him. For him, male homosexuality was the passive feminine role or the passive homosexual role. I mean, as you said, as the surgeon who had actually penetrated his body, Freud's homosexual desires to be penetrated by him were activated. But insofar as he thought Fleece as the medicine man, the witch doctor, the magician, the shaman, contained all these magical powers, he was the object of a maternal transference, where the fantasy is the mother has all this wonderful warm milk that can alleviate all my discomfort and suffering.
Mm. And I guess that pre-Oedipal transference is the one that would be more difficult for Freud,
yes,
to verbalize or to get at.
Yeah. I mean, for Freud, one of the last things Freud said, I mean, this way I almost end the book, he says that there is a limit to how far a man can go in psychoanalysis, because to put himself on the couch and put himself in a passive position to an analyst, a male or female, men, because of their fear of their passive homosexual female wishes, can never allow themselves to really give themselves over to analysis.
Sure.
And he called this the biological red bedrock, which constituted the limit to how far an analysis could go. Now, my point is, because of his own discomfort with his own passive feminine wishes, Freud couldn't explore them sufficiently. So rather than saying this fear of passivity is bedrock, what he should have done, and what we're trying to do today, is to analyze that fear of passivity and to understand where it arises in male development and partly in man's relationship to his separating from his mother.
Right. It wasn't a biological bedrock. It was his own personal bedrock, which may have been shared by a lot of other people, but and can be related to all the trauma in his early childhood.
Right. And by saying it's bedrock, what you do is you arrest curiosity. You arrest exploration. It, like everything else, should have been a topic for psychoanalytic exploration. He couldn't get curious about his own rejection of the passive female position. He couldn't get curious enough.
And I understand that. There's so much I want to cover, and we're running out of time. But I wondered, you know, another thing that you get into is his illness and his terrible illness and the amount of pain he went through and his confronting death. And I was really taken by your description of his grandson's game, the Fort Dog game, which I never really seen the significance of. I wondered if you could tell our listeners about that.
Well, you know, he observed his grandson playing this game over and over again, where he would have a spool of yarn and throw it and then retrieve it. And he would yell "Fort" when he threw it. And then when he pulled it back in, he would say "Da." So there, here. And the boy had a very good relationship with his mother. And he actually handled the separations from her very well and would play this game when she was gone. And Freud, as well as his mother, became very curious about the meaning of it. And what Freud came to conclude or to hypothesize was that in this game, the child was reenacting and overcoming the separation. So the throwing the spool was a separation, and the bringing it back in was mastering it. Mm. And this was the key to something that he saw as a fundamental mechanism in psychic life and in culture. By doing this, he was not just mastering it, but he was mastering it by symbolizing it,
yes,
and acting it.
As he calls his Freud calls his grandson's great cultural achievement.
Great cultural achievement. Because, one of the great facts of the human condition that we all have to face, and one of the great tasks, is how we are going to deal with all of the inevitable separations and losses that we have to experience in life. And Freud's answer is that the way we learn to deal with them and the way we make them tolerable is through symbolic activity, by symbolizing them.
And by play. Play.
Yeah. I mean, Winnicott went on to say by play. I mean, there's an intimate connection between play and symbolization. And by doing this, we not only learn to tolerate separation and loss, but we also create meaning out of it. I mean, symbolizing loss is the source of meaning for Freud.
Right. That's fascinating. And that's just one nugget. There are so many others. I wish I could talk to you about more, but we are at the end of our 50-minute hour.
As we analysts say, time's up.
Which is terribly traumatic for a pre-Oedipal patient. But I really appreciate you. You're taking the time to talk with me. I really enjoyed the book. And thank you for appearing on New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Okay, I also want to thank you for asking very insightful questions.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Facilitating the discussion.
Thank you.